It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the first case of Ebola in the United States. While CDC officials have said they have plans in place to isolate and treat any Ebola patients in the U.S., our next guest says the announcement is likely to cause a good deal of worry, maybe panic around the country.
However, he says the case brings up some ethical questions that need to be talked about in a calm and productive way.
Joining us now is Arthur Kaplan. He's the director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. Arthur, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, you say that people are going to feel a fair amount of panic surrounding this announcement. I mean, do we have good cause to be worried, if not panicked?
We don't have any reason to be panicked. I think there's reason to pay attention. I don't expect that a lot of folks are going to intersect Ebola. There are many other health things, health problems, just the ordinary flu, for example. We're just entering flu season. They're going to pose more challenges. But you want to make sure that people understand exactly what's happening with that patient in Dallas. You want the details, not the names or the addresses. I think that's wrong to give any of that out. But here's what happened. Here's how we're tracking it. Here's how we're dealing with it. This is where they went. This is who they contacted. This is who we're tracing. You need that story because you got to make sure people trust that you're really on top of this.
And you've written a piece that appeared in Forbes called Five Ethical Points Now That Ebola Has Entered the U.S., and that actually was one of your points. You're looking for clear and transparent communication from the CDC and other public health officials. Why is that so important?
I think the CDC attitude and some of the health officials in Texas has been, we're on it, trust us, we are taking this very seriously, and the boots are on the ground. But I think a lot of folks are a little bit skeptical. Maybe some, maybe not a lot, but some are skeptical, and they are going to say, you know, maybe you're not telling us all the truth, or maybe you're covering something up. So I think the way you cement that trust is you get as transparent as possible. You don't say, we can't give you any details because of privacy. What you do say is, we're not going to give any names, we're not going to give you any addresses, we're not going to give you anything that would disclose where these people are. But we can tell you the story of what we're doing, and then you'll buy in and see, yeah, you really are on top of this.
Now, on one practical level, there have been, one instant reaction sometimes is, let's close down travel from the countries affected by Ebola. You don't buy that. What are you looking for instead?
So I don't think that makes much sense, partly because boats and planes can get here from other countries. We're not going to shut down all travel that is going to come here, and people from Africa can come the long way around and still get here pretty quickly. So I don't think you're going to see a complete air traffic shutdown. What you could see is some advice, for example, what I haven't seen yet for passengers. If you see someone who's sick or sweaty or throwing up on the plane, it might be important to know who to say something to. I fully support that. I think that's prudent. Better screening. We should make sure that before you get on the plane, you get asked a series of questions about symptoms. When you get off the plane, you should be asked a series of questions about symptoms and where you've been and what countries you've been through and all that. Much more aggressive. We did it a little bit, if you remember, for pandemic flu. We should be doing it much more aggressively for Ebola.
Now, this first case in Texas was detected in a hospital after a first try where the patient evidently was sent home. Are local hospitals around the country knowing what to look out for and what to do if there's a possible case of Ebola?
Can't answer that, and that's another problem. I think the public should know not only what are they doing at the CDC, which is great, but what's happening in Milwaukee? What's actually happening in hospitals all around the country? Is your local hospital ready to deal with an Ebola patient? If an Ebola patient wound up visiting someone in Wisconsin and became very sick, should they be taken to the Mayo Clinic? Should they go to someplace in Atlanta? Or can the local facility absolutely isolate them and handle that situation? We haven't heard about training of the hospitals. We haven't heard about the admission priorities of hospitals. We ought to know that. So I'm not happy with that public communication either.
Are hospitals ready to deal with a lot of people seeing these stories in the media, getting worried that the cold or mild flu might be Ebola and flooding urgent care centers, emergency rooms?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really worries me. So where we are right now, start of October, is the beginning of the flu season. Most people hear that the early symptoms of Ebola are flu-like symptoms. They may not be paying attention to the fact that you don't have to worry too much about this if you haven't been in Western Africa or you haven't been taking care of someone with Ebola. They just hear flu-like symptoms and off they go. So no, I don't think, again, we're doing enough communication to say, yeah, you want to watch for those flu-like symptoms if you've been exposed to someone because you're trying to take care of them. That's usually a healthcare worker, or you've traveled. I worry at the start of the flu season that we're also not saying, hey, this is really the year to get the flu shot because you might as well weed yourself out of that set of symptoms so you don't overwhelm the system even further. You know, the ERs during flu season are jammed. And if we have more people trying to get in there because they have false fears about Ebola, it's really going to make a mess.
Getting back to your recommendations, you see we need to clarify the rights of families to dictate disposal of bodies should there be a death related to Ebola. Why is that important?
If you looked at the terrible epidemic in West Africa, it's clear that the reason it has spread far is that they have not handled dead bodies in ways that would prevent transmission of the disease. It's not that people are giving each other the disease through fluid contact, although certainly some have, but they have a dead body that's still infectious. It's got a lot of virus still in it, and they caress the body, and they wrap the body, and they bathe the body, and they kiss the body, and that's where trouble starts. You can't deal with dead bodies that way if they die of Ebola. You're going to have to pretty much get them isolated and then cremate them. So I don't think we're going to have a lot of choices if someone dies here and they say religiously or culturally, I want to have this kind of funeral or I want to do this or that. That can't happen, and we might as well say that clearly now.
So this is a case where on the ethics side, the balance should be public safety over a religious or cultural freedom.
Exactly.
And then finally, and obviously when we talk the healthcare system in the United States, cost always comes up. Have we talked about how we're going to pay for Ebola screening, Ebola treatment, should it become more necessary?
We haven't, and that's another problem, and here's why. Let's say you were someone who was a visitor here, and you got sick, and you're thinking, I don't know if they're going to pay for my care, and I don't want to burden my family that's here or my relatives. I'll just stay home until I'm really sure that I'm sick. You don't want to do that. You don't want people who are here illegally and somehow get exposed not to go into the hospital. You want everybody to go to the hospital if they really show these severe signs of vomiting and diarrhea and the inability to walk and so forth, and they've been in places where Ebola has been. So we better make it clear that we're happy to take care of everybody, no matter whether they're insured or they're not insured, because the worst thing you can do is mimic what we've seen in Western Africa, which is people staying at home, dying at home, and infecting their families.
Now, big picture, you've pointed out a lot of flaws in communication, in part, in decisions that are as yet unmade. By and large, our public health system, do you think it's ready for a threat like Ebola, that it won't spread as quickly as it did, as you mentioned, in those West African countries?
It's far more ready than those West African countries, but it's not where it should be. We don't have good outreach into the hospitals to make sure that every resident knows that when you take a history from someone with flu-like symptoms, you want to ask them where they've traveled. We don't really have a tough, aggressive public health system that can do surveillance accurately of what's going on. We've chopped the budget up and cut back. It isn't where it should be. And a lesson just down the road, whether it's Ebola or tuberculosis or some other disease that's highly infectious, we got to beef that public health system back up. We're in a small world and things move quick, and we can't get by with a public health system that sort of ends at our borders.
Arthur, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That's Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. He joins us to talk about the first case of Ebola diagnosed in the U.S. and the ethical points that, and some practical ones, too, that need to be discussed going forward. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. A lot of polling sources show that a GOP takeover of the Senate is increasingly likely. Early in September, it looked much closer.
And the Secret Service is taking heat from Congress over significant slip-ups, including a White House intruder armed with a knife, and some breaking news there about Julia Pearson, director of Secret Service.
And closer to home, the House Office of Congressional Ethics concluded yesterday that there's substantial reason to believe that Wisconsin Representative Tom Petri broke House ethics rules.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Veronica? Good talk to you.
Doing well, thanks. So let's get to this news that just broke in the last half hour. So Julia Pearson, director of the Secret Service, has resigned. Now, earlier it was reported that she had not been asked to resign. She faced some tough grilling, but that was not on the table. What happened?
Well, you know, starting this morning, Democrats, including the senior Democratic member of that committee that grilled her yesterday, began to say they thought that they had lost confidence in her. She had lost the confidence of the American people and of the agency that she led, and it was time for her to step down. And at 4 o'clock Eastern time, which is right about now, Senator Schumer, who's a leader in the Democratic Party, was going to have a press conference calling for her resignation. She beat him to the punch by about an hour and announced that she was stepping down. And I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that obviously the Secret Service has been, you know, repeatedly buffeted by a scandal over the past couple of years. The fact that they got this fence jumper made it all the way into the middle of the White House, and then yesterday there was another revelation that security guard who was carrying a gun and was a convicted felon ended up in an elevator with President Obama, and the White House did not find that out until it was reported in the newspaper yesterday. I think it became time to go.
And there were the gunshots at the White House that were only discovered much after the fact by a cleaning crew, apparently.
Yeah. She was saying during the testimony yesterday that she felt actually the Secret Service responded appropriately to that incident because, her point, they heard the shots outside and responded to the shots and the shooter, but they thought that the shots were directed at a bunch of people on the street. They thought a gunfight had broken out on the street. So they were chasing people outside, not realizing that a bullet had traveled into the White House. I, you know, can't judge whether that would have been something that should have been obvious to them. I just don't know. But obviously that testimony was met with some derision in Congress.
How long had she been in that position?
About a year and a half, because remember, they had recently had a scandal at the Secret Service with Secret Service officers hiring prostitutes while on detail in, I think it was Columbia, if I'm remembering correctly. And part of the response to that problem was they really believed there was an old boys network at the Secret Service that allowed poor behavior by agents, and Obama appointed Pearson, the first woman to hold that position, in part as a way to sort of changing of the guard and to clearing out the old boys network. So she was a short-timer in this post, and now they're going to have to go find somebody else.
Right. So any idea what sort of direction the White House will be looking, given this latest try didn't work out?
No idea. At the moment, they've appointed some guy as a temporary whose name is escaping me right now, but he was a former head of security at Comcast, the cable company. But he also was a former Secret Service agent, but he most recently had been in retirement and working for Comcast. I do not know where you go look for a Secret Service head at this point. I think it's a little too early to tell for that.
Now, as far as you know, has this kind of thing ever happened before? For example, has someone made it into the White House armed and overpowered an agent inside?
No, not so far as I know. I mean, there have been these kind of problems before. I mean, you may recall, I don't remember what year it was, but it was a decade or so ago that an armed intruder made it into the U.S. Capitol and wrestled with the guards and was running down the hall towards one of the House leadership offices and was shot in the hallway by Capitol Police. And two Capitol Police officers were killed by that intruder that day, which led to a beefing up of security at the U.S. Capitol building. That was a great tragedy, and those two officers are still enshrined in a plaque in the Capitol building. So it happens. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that none of our security systems are ever impenetrable. You know, I think the good news in this particular case is that this guy got over the fence, got into the building, and was unable to do any damage to anybody. It's not clear he was really arm to do much damage. He had a knife, but no bombs, no guns.
And it looks like Joseph Clancy is being tapped to be the interim replacement at this time. We're going to move on now and talk about the scene for the November elections. And polls are showing a change now that the race, instead of being very tight, neck and neck for the Senate, is looking as though the GOP has the leg up. What's happened?
Yeah, I don't believe that poll.
It's a bunch of polls, though, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the problem. Nationally, it's a state-by-state issue. The national averages are really hard to assess because every state is different. Right now, something very weird is going on in Kansas. We have a new poll out today suggesting that the independent might win that race, not the Republican, not the Democrat. The Democrat actually dropped off the ballot. There is a race in North Carolina. It looked like the Democrat was in serious trouble. Now the Democrat may be actually creeping a little bit ahead. Where the Democrats seem to be in real trouble is in Louisiana and Arkansas, where the incumbent Democrats are really struggling. And, by the way, I should mention, every time something bad happens in the White House, like this Secret Service thing that sort of paints a picture of incompetence in the government and the government that the Democrats are running, it hurts Democrats' chances. I know that's a complicated thought, but basically, if the Democrats need people to go out and vote for Democrats, they need people to be excited about voting for Democrats. And when the Democrats who run the government end up looking like goofballs, it's hard to get people to the polls. So, yeah, my impression is that the needle is moving in several races in Republican favor, but the needle is also moving in Democrats' favor in a couple of these races as well. And it's just impossible to tell on a national average whether Republicans are going to win or lose. It's going to be a state-by-state issue in a half dozen seats.
So you're not putting your money on any of these polls, even though it's Nate Silver, Paul.
Yeah, well, and I don't put any money on any of the polls because particularly in state polling, there's all kinds of flaws in the polls. They're very small pools. You're talking about most of these races are within the margin of error of the poll. You know, I do not put my faith in anything until people reach for the lever and pull it. Until then, it's all speculation. Informed speculation, absolutely, but all speculation.
It's a pretty safe position at this point. Well, let's talk a little bit about money, because as I understand it, as it's being reported, Democrats and Republicans saying, the sky is falling, we need more money, the other side has more of it, donate now. So what's happening with the money scene?
The money scene is interesting because, as I know your listeners are familiar, after this Citizens United case a couple of years ago, outside third-party money has begun flooding into congressional races. You know, we'll spend $1 billion of outside money this year on Senate and congressional races. So, everybody is sending out emails saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And, in fact, what's happening is, it's like an arms race. Everybody needs more money to keep up with the last guy's money. And it is money for advertising. It is money for door-to-door campaigns. You're talking about those races where Democrats are in trouble. The Democrats are spending millions of dollars on phone banks, on door-to-door door-knocking efforts, on voter outreach and registration. They are trying to move a ground game that will get people to the polls and save them in a couple places. That's what they're all begging for money for. They need to fund a get-out-the-vote machine. And it starts now. A lot of these places, voting has already begun. Early voting has already begun.
Now, looking at some Wisconsin news in the House yesterday, the House Office of Congressional Ethics concluded that there is substantial reason to believe that Representative Tom Petri broke House ethics rules.
Right.
What did he do?
My colleague Donovan Slack actually broke this story that Petri was going to agencies of the government to intervene on behalf of companies in which he owned stock. And it looks like he was buying stock somewhere around the time that government actions that he knew about were taking place that benefited the stock. And so we're not saying that he, you know, immediately went out of his way to try and enrich himself. We're saying is he took actions he shouldn't have taken that benefited companies that he owned stock in. And what the Office of Congressional Ethics reviewed the stories that Donovan had written and concluded that, in fact, Petri had violated a conflict of interest rule by getting actively involved in stock in companies that he had an ownership position. Now, they're just recommending that the House Ethics Committee look into this further. They can't actually punish him. And Petri has since announced that he's not going to run for re-election, in part, we think, because of this investigation.
All right, Paul, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. Have a great day.
You too. We've been talking to Paul Singer, USA Today politics editor. He joins us every week at this time to break down what's happening in Congress. Right now, we're getting up to speed on a new trend, slow reading. You may have heard about a return to more time-consuming arts, slow food, or the maker movement, whose members invest time in creating stuff by hand.
The new slow reading movement wants to do reading the old-fashioned way, without distraction, with a goal of comprehension and total immersion before the age of smartphones and hyperlinks and social media alerts.
Jeannie Whalen joins us now. She's deputy director. She's deputy bureau chief of health and science at the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
So where did this idea for slow reading clubs come from?
So the idea started with some academics and writers who've written books about the virtues of slow reading, which doesn't actually mean reading at a slow pace. It more means, just actually focusing on your reading and not getting interrupted by email and cell phones and the like. So some writers and some academics started writing about this several years back about our need to return to that sort of reading and the benefits of it. And now some reading groups have cropped up that also kind of embrace the idea.
So tell us about these groups. What happens at a slow reading club?
So they turn up, and instead of discussing a book, they will just sit down and all read together in silence for about an hour. That's kind of how it works. And the point of it isn't to talk about literature, but actually just to put aside some time to actually devote to reading without getting distracted by email and Twitter and the like.
Did you go to one of these things?
I didn't know. I talked to some people, though, who ran them in Wellington, New Zealand, and in Brooklyn and in Seattle. And they all described something similar, which is just that they felt that life had become too hectic and they had lost some of the reading skills that they used to really enjoy. And they just wanted to kind of reclaim them and had set up these groups where you come and you switch off your cell phones, and sometimes they have some classical music playing and, you know, beer or wine, and you just sit down and read.
Now, a lot of people just anecdotally have noticed that it seems to be getting harder to really sink into a long piece of writing, whether it's a novel or a long magazine feature. Is there evidence to back that up, that people busy on their devices might actually be losing that old school skill of really reading a book carefully?
Yeah, so there is some evidence that when we read online, for instance, we don't comprehend as much. So there's some evidence to show that when we read text that's peppered with a lot of links, with a lot of hyperlinks, our comprehension of the information is worse than if we had just read plain text. There's also some research showing that if we read multimedia presentations where there's lots of audio and whizzing pictures and blinking lights, that, again, our comprehension is lower than if we had just read a plain piece of text.
And scientists have also found, it sounds like, the way we read has really changed from, you know, the standard reading from left to right to, you know, kind of a weird F pattern. What's happening there?
That's right. So some researchers measured the eye movements of people who were reading on web pages and found that instead of just reading left to right like we used to do, we skip around a lot in a kind of wild hunting pattern now, looking for keywords, and that when they kind of attached cameras to their eye movements, they saw that the people read all the way across the top line of text on a web page, but with each subsequent line, they would read only to the middle of the page until eventually toward the bottom of the page, they were just skimming straight down the left side of the page toward the bottom of the screen. So kind of progressively looking at less and less of the text as they went down the screen, in sort of an F pattern, like the letter F.
So is there any evidence that reading like that is harder on our brains?
Harder on our brains. I think the evidence that I cited earlier about how we just seem to comprehend and retain less when we read online is sort of the main point. The internet has been really useful for all of us to kind of hunt around and find new information quickly. But when it comes to reading something long and complex and retaining it and kind of analyzing it, it seems not as well suited for that as a book would be. And some research has shown that actually students still prefer to read textbooks when they are trying to absorb something complicated than trying to read it online.
Besides pleasure, what are some of the benefits of reading slowly and carefully?
So the people who do it say that they feel, you know, a sense of calm, that it reduces stress, it helps them concentrate more, it improves their vocabulary and their ability to write, even improves their listening skills. But I guess the main benefit that I heard many people citing was just that it brought them a sense of calm and kind of slowed down their breathing and their pace of life for an hour or two.
Is there any correlation, though, between reading a lot, maybe in the younger years, and good outcomes later in life?
There are. There has been some research showing, and this, you know, won't be surprising to anyone, that children who have stronger reading skills in first grade tend to have better academic achievements in the 11th grade. So that's just a correlation. It's not a causation, but it does suggest that, you know, good reading skills can contribute to better outcomes for students down the road.
Now, for someone who's hearing this and thinks, yeah, this kind of sounds like me, I do have trouble concentrating on longer books, what's some advice for being able to return to slow reading, careful reading?
So some of the advice that I heard most often was obviously switch off your phone or even leave it in another room, switch off your computer, leave it in another room, or leave it at home and go somewhere where you're not going to be distracted by your technology. Dedicate at least an hour to the reading if you can, and maybe try to schedule it as you would exercise time so that you don't, you know, forget about it or back out on it. And then some people also did say that reading paper books might be better than ebooks, because with a novel, like a paper printed novel, you kind of tend to see it sitting around your house more often, and it's a good reminder to read. Although plenty of people said that reading on an ebook is just as good as long as you are really focusing on your reading and not getting interrupted by Facebook and the like.
So we're supposed to set aside a block of time, right? Something like 45 minutes, an hour. Do most people have that much time to read anymore?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like probably not, right? Because we're all busy. But I guess the point is you really have to make the time as you would for anything else important, like exercise or spending time with your family and that sort of thing.
Now, these slow reading clubs have been cropping up. You said Wellington, New Zealand is one that's on the vanguard. There is one in Minneapolis, Boston, Seattle. Is there evidence that this is kind of catching on?
You know, those are the ones that I came across, and I since then have gotten lots of emails from people asking me, you know, how do I set up a club like this of my own, or how do I find a group in my hometown? I know the woman I interviewed from New Zealand said that she's been inundated with requests from people wanting her to help them set up slow reading clubs. So I think certainly it is catching on, yes.
Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Jeannie Whalen, Deputy Bureau Chief of Health and Science at the Wall Street Journal. She's been talking about the rise of slow reading, catching on in clubs across the world, really, and an indication that people seem to want to go back to being able to concentrate and really sink into a book. We're talking about the rise of the slow reading movement and slow reading clubs. It's a response to the worry that people are reading books less, and there is some evidence to back that up. And also that when we do sit down with a book, that we're really not able to concentrate the way we may have done before the advent of smartphones and email and digital distractions. And we're wondering what you think about this.
You can call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have trouble concentrating on a serious read or a fun read for that matter? Are we just too distracted to sit down and take the time and really get absorbed in what we're reading? And would you schedule time? Do you schedule time to read? And would you read in a room full of other people like these slow reading clubs are doing? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to our callers. We've got Kelly on the line in Ashland. Kelly, hi.
Hi.
So what's your story?
So I actually just moved to Wisconsin about a month ago.
Welcome.
And yeah, we're glad to be here. And in the time, it took us a little while to figure out a new internet provider. It took about 2 weeks, and we actually realized in those 2 weeks of not having internet at our house that we were reading so much that we've actually decided not to get internet at our own house. Yeah, we couldn't believe how much time apparently we've been wasting on Netflix and Facebook and Twitter, and I mean, I love all those things, but we've also now been reading about a novel a week a piece, which we haven't done in years.
Do you feel like you're enjoying life, apart from being in Wisconsin, of course, do you feel like you're enjoying life more now that you're reading so much?
Yeah, because it's like having a friend in a new place where we don't have a lot of friends yet, like getting into these novels so deeply. We're discussing the characters, we're exchanging books, so we temporarily have new friends here.
Kelly, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that. What's your latest novel, Kelly, before you go?
Oh, I just read The Master Butcher's Singing Club by Louise Erdich.
Okay.
Really good.
Well, and enjoy your future reading, Kelly. That's, you know, we were just talking about that earlier today, Veronica. Like, I love reading, and then sometimes I'll just be sitting and looking at things on the internet, and then I'll suddenly think that was like 40 minutes that I could have been reading something that advance the human race not at all by what I just spent that time doing.
Or yourself.
Or myself.
Right, yeah. And I had an experience where I sat down to read one of my favorite books, and it's a trilogy, and I petered out after the first book, and I'm still appalled, and I'm thinking of trying the slow reading thing. I don't know if I do it in a club, but I think it's worth investigating for me.
Spoiler alert, The Hobbit wins.
it was the Lord of the Rings.
I knew it.
All right. Anyway, you know too much, Rob Ferret. Okay. Thanks to Kelly, and on to Larry in New Berlin. Hey, Larry.
Hi. Interesting conversation. Interesting topic. I think, you know, in terms of reading for fun, there was that recent article about Eminem and Beethoven using essentially stimulating in the same way the same parts of the brain, which was kind of astounding. So I imagine that if people want to read for fun or listen to Eminem and stimulate their brains, that's a wonderful thing. But the pattern that you were talking about in terms of seeking behavior seems very goal-oriented, and I think people may have gotten much more efficient about getting information. And from what I understand, if your brain is actively focused on seeking information, it also takes in peripheral information and records it much better. That's old reading research. I don't know if maybe it's been supplanted by new reading research. Those things happen. But it seems to me like there's a lot that's healthy. Now, the distractions you talked about are the blinking lights and the ads popping up and stuff. Are bound to reduce concentration. And if you have somebody with attention deficit, they can get lost in the links and forget what they were looking for. But, you know, there's a lot that's positive about this, that everybody is reading with the internet. And that's not something you could have said 20 years before the internet.
Right, that's everyone is reading. We might not be reading War and Peace, but people are reading more. So do you think overall it's a net gain?
I think it's definitely a net gain. I'm not sure. I mean, Tolstoy's concept of people being collective and mutualistic and stuff like that is certainly something our society could use right now. But in general, I don't know that literary writing is more than a class difference from many of the wonderful things being promoted on television shows, actually.
Gotcha, Larry. Some interesting points there. Yeah. Thank you so much for calling.
Back to our callers now with Rebecca in Cascade. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. I have to say my family has not had TV for 10 years, and I know a lot of people think that's really strange. And it did take a period of adjustment because I was not raised that way at all. Opposite, in fact. But we read. That you find so much more to life than watching garbage.
So was there a revolt in your family when the TV first went away? Did it take time?
Yeah. It not a revolt like, I hate you, but a revolt like, what are we supposed to do? I'm so bored. But kids adapt, and kids find other things to do, productive things to do. They start painting and exploring and playing and actually talking to us.
That's great.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, that's great, Rebecca. Glad you're spending your time with the reading and painting, things like that. It's a big move, though. I'm not sure everybody's ready, Veronica, to ditch the TV set just yet.
We went without TV for a while, and yeah, we switched providers, and I don't know. I got to say, I did miss it. Okay. I don't know if I read anymore or not.
I think it's like you have to go a long time and break through that initial dependency
right,
or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Rebecca. And we're going to go next to Maria in Oconomowoc. And by the way, you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think? Are we losing our capacity to really sink into a good long book, concentrate on it, understand it, and immerse ourselves? Or do you think, you know, we are reading more overall? We're just reading online, we're reading shorter stuff, and that's worth something too. What do you think? And what do you consider to be the benefits of reading? 800-642-1234. Hi, Maria.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I love reading. I've been a reader my whole life, and I have lots of things that I do that help me to continue to be a reader. And I write down every book that I read. When I finish it, I log it. So I know that I've read 77 books since January 1st, 2013 until today. 77. And I read a variety of books, fiction, nonfiction, books that are 800 pages, books that are 300 pages, you know, just a variety. And I try not to turn the TV on until 7 p.m. So once I get, I mean, I work full time, so and usually overtime as well. So it's not that I don't work, but I try and read on the weekends, and then in the evenings I try and read until 7, and then I can watch TV and veg, you know, and watch my favorite shows. But I just think this slow movement thing is just a fantastic idea. And we have a little free library in our front yard. So we're all about just books and reading and trying to, you know, hook people up with books. And the mm-hmm. other thing that we do is paper books are, to me, fantastic. I'm a computer junkie. I have the iPhone. I have everything. But I just love the paper books for some reason.
And real quick, Maria, before I let you go, so obviously reading is important to you. You carved out a lot of time to read in your daily life. What are the benefits for you?
Well, I think that I know a lot of history. I know a lot of trivia. I just read a book that was based on World War II. It's going to be a movie this fall, Unbroken. Mm. It's fantastic. And I learned so much from reading that book. I think that I have some patience. I can sit and read quietly for quite a long period of time if I want to. And I can listen to people because I'm not, you know, just having to just have things be quick and choppy. I mean, there are just so many benefits. I'm also very good in English, spelling, all of those things. And I think that's from being hatched a reader as a young kid.
Okay.
I always did very well.
Great. Thank you so much, Maria. She's got so many wonderful thoughts about what reading's done for her, and someone who's carved out a lot of time to read.
Yeah, and a lot of quantification there. It's very data-driven reading, too.
77 books.
Yeah. Shelley now is with us in Duluth. Shelley, hi.
Yes, hello. I found the idea of a slow reading club very appealing until she came to the idea of turning on classical music while reading. And I think that's a terrible idea. I can understand a book reading group, and I can understand a classical music listening group, but to run the both of them concurrently would drive me nuts because there's so much to listen to as far as structure and abstract drama in a Mozart or Haydn symphony. And the idea of having that while trying to read is, I think, a bad idea.
Well, you think that defeats the purpose, it sounds like, of concentrated, immersive reading.
For me, not only that would drive me nuts. It would be like someone reciting poetry while I'm trying to read a book.
That is a challenge. Shelley, thank you so much. Happy reading and listening to you, but not at the same time.
Okay, and next we go to Mike in Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to echo the comments of the caller that had called in and said that maybe that there's really a bit of a class difference as opposed to a qualitative difference. And the comments that have been reflective of positive of reading, you hear things like the crap on TV. And I guess what I would say is that it's an election to decide to watch one thing or another thing, and that really maybe achieving a little bit of a balance. Like if you're all you're doing is consuming internet or all you're doing is consuming television, perhaps you want to try to expose yourself to some other areas of information collection. And art, obviously, is available on any of those three mediums. So it's not just information. There's an enormous amount of art that is available to people that would never have been available to people. And that is even more true when you start talking about the masses of people who don't live in the United States.
Gotcha, Mike. Thank you so much for those thoughts. You know, Mike's suggesting that we need a balance of things, and it's healthy to look at it that way, too, instead of just focusing on one of these, which is reading.
Yeah, I like some of this stuff on TV, to be fair. Jennifer on Facebook writes, after working online for 20 years and intensively in social media, I realized a few years ago my concentration span was shot. She writes, once an avid reader of nonfiction and fiction, couple books a week, I found I hadn't even picked up a novel in months. Now I actively build time into my work schedule to read for an hour at the end of my day and time to read fiction at night. It helped a lot, but it was scary how far I strayed from the full-on reading, not skimming fold. Well, that's pretty inspiring, actually. I definitely catch myself moving over that line to too much skimming things online, not enough immersing myself in really reading.
Great. And it's so interesting to hear from everyone, you know, in a culture that is moving in this direction toward the digital, how people are coping and what they're doing to balance it out. So thank you, everyone, for your calls. We've been talking about the rise of slow reading. There are clubs across the world that are picking up steam where people just get together and read books in silence.
Are you going to scale the Two Towers now?
I don't know. I think I might move on to something else and take another swing later on. But I'm definitely going to be reading.